Yes, PNG. Feel free to comment.
Correct. W2PND. Pennies, nickels, and dimes. Hi, Roy. It's Paul on Staten Island. Just some comments on the hacking, the phone hacking. Hope still exists. The last one was held 2 years ago at St. John's University, and they're held every 2 years, so there will be one in 2024.
Oh, that's good to hear. I'm very pro white hat. Not so much black hat, but I think white hats are great guys.
Oh, that's the majority of them. They are just there to learn and explore the way we did back in the day with the blue boxes. And by the way, there's a book by Phil Lapsley. It's called Exploding the Phone, and that book can describe it all. Over.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, there were more than a few reasonably well-written books. I remember the way I actually discovered it. I was minding my own business in my local public library, which I was a kid at the time, and I loved that library. It gave me my education. I spent way too many hours in the lower level reference section. But I, for some reason, picked up a copy of Esquire magazine, and on the cover was an article about blue boxes, and I was fascinated from that point on.
Yes, I believe that article in Esquire was the basic for Phil's book. I can't say for sure he was the author of both, but that was the inspiration for the book.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, that article was Secrets of a Little Blue Box in Esquire magazine. I think I still have the article here somewhere. There were a number of articles written about. I remember one time at City College, I got out an issue of the Bell System Technical Journal and went to the page there that had the frequencies, the multi-frequencies published there, and somebody wrote on it, photostat, do not rip out, think of others. So apparently there was quite a bit of activity going on. Also, I thought the Hope conferences, are they no longer at the Hotel Pennsylvania? I remember several of them used to be at the Hotel Pennsylvania in the city. Go ahead.
Yeah, W2PND. They are now at St. John's University. Like I said, every 2 years, they held one a year or so ago, but it was impacted heavily by COVID, and everyone's looking forward for the next one in 2024.
Yeah, I think I'll attend.
Yeah, very good. If anyone from here actually does attend, please come back and tell us about it. Again, that was kind of my earliest. Not my interest in electronics, because I had taken apart radios and telephones and all kinds of weird things, but the more kind of subversive aspect of technology, it was a bit of an awakening.
And just one more note, 2600 magazine is still available. I don't know if any newsstands, but you can get it online. You can get it through Amazon subscriptions, and they are still going along.
Comment?
Yes, John. By the way, are there still newsstands?
Comment?
Yes, please feel free to comment.
Yeah, I remember, who was it? The person who ran 2600 Magazine, he used to have a program on WBAI called Off the Hook. I don't know if that program still comes on. I haven't listened to BAI during that time slot. I'm usually doing other things. But I remember he used to come on, I think, Wednesday evening. He used to have a program called Off the Hook. It was run by Emmanuel Goldstein, I think was his pseudonym, and he was the one that would organize the Hope conferences and also do 2600 magazine.
W2PND. Yeah, he's still around as far as I know. I think they do some kind of broadcast on BAI and also on the internet. And that's about it. Can't think of any more. W2PND.
Okay, that's a great name, Emmanuel Goldstein. How many people out there understand where that name came from?
That's from one of the, what was that story? I can't think of the name, but yeah, it was from one of the stories. I remember seeing the movie. But...
yeah, it's 1984. It was a fictitious enemy of the state.
JD2NBB.
Yes.
Yes, I just pulled up 2600.com just to confirm. I had to listen to it for a couple of months. The show is still on WBAI, and you can also... they have archived all their programs within a day or two after this program. You can listen to any of them online. He has Emmanuel also has another show, the WUSB, through Stony Brook, called Off the Wall. You can, those shows are archived. It's the only way I can listen to them because I can't pick up that signal. But anyway, 2600, yes, I also went to, I didn't go to the conference last summer at St. John's College. I was thinking about if I didn't go, but I went to all the other ones since 2012, and including one on 2021 that was completely online, you know, through not things like Zoom, and because of the pandemic, of course. So, yeah, that's it. Back to you. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Thanks for that information, Bob. WBAI is still around and still being subversive. Nice to know that you can rely on some things to never change.
Those shows and the conferences, I mean, these issues of the privacy and the surveillance, I mean, they're kind of ahead of most people's curve. I mean, they've been talking about this for over a decade at the conferences and also on their shows and all this stuff. So, anyway, yeah, it's a very interesting program.
Well, you know, I mean, this has been an ongoing topic for science fiction. There have been many dystopic societies where you are forced to watch the television for propaganda, but the television was usually wired both ways. So while you watch them propagandize, they watched you do whatever you did. So Big Brother is always watching, going back to the good old 1984 again. So, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there isn't someone out to get you.
Exactly. Yeah, but they've actually brought up these issues. I mean, even long before I started going to these things or even knew who they were, I think they're old. You can also find the archives of all these talks on the on all those conferences. I think they're all free on YouTube. And you can buy discs and stuff from 2600 with all these talks nicely organized. You can probably find just about all of them on YouTube, grouped according to the year. You can go back to the 90s when people were starting to talk about these things coming up, not as a science fiction, but as people who had no stuff talking about it, you know, that this is the reality coming up. Back to that.
Yeah, well, with many aspects of science fiction, it's just a matter of time. You know, sometimes they go into sheer fantasy or kind of pseudoscience, but a lot of times either it's the inevitable consequence of man's drives or occasionally it's self-fulfilling prophecies. I use as an example the communicator on Star Trek looked a lot like a StarTAC. As a matter of fact, one of the probable reasons why I bought the StarTAC back in its time. And most likely the reason that the StarTAC looked so much like the communicator was probably the engineers who built the StarTAC watched Star Trek when I did back in the 60s. So So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, they do lots of stuff at those conferences. Some of them are fact, science, or it's claimed to be, whether you would agree or not, a lot of it is. And they also do stuff, they play with sci-fi and stuff. They're all into that kind of stuff. And one thing I wanted to bring up from an earlier, you were talking about Captain Crunch. There was at least one guy in those times who didn't need to have a whistle because he had perfect pitch. He was a blind guy, and he could just whistle the signal. So that was quite interesting. Back to Ned.
Yeah, I vaguely remember him, but I, for the life of me, I don't remember his name. Do you remember his name?
By Phil Lapsley as well.
I'm sorry I doubled with you. Does anyone know that guy's name? Because I can't remember it in the slightest.
I could look it up. I have the book also on my Kindle. I read it also, Exploding the Phone. I read it a few years ago. It's in there somewhere. This is KE2MDD, back to Ned.
Okay, it looks like I'm going to have to spend more money on another Kindle book. By the way, enjoying my Kindle. It's a good toy to play with. I like the larger viewing screen. I like the bright illumination. I think it's a good purchase. A little bit overpriced for what it is, but that's the nature of the beast. Anyone else with any comments before we close this portion of the technical net?
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
It's an interesting thought on your observation about the phone, the Star Attack phone and Star Trek and the Star Trek communicator, and the concept of I suppose you would call technology imitating art imitating technology, or life imitating art, those types of concepts. I would throw at you that the Star Trek was a good design, better than the Star Trek communicator, and it culminated in the Nokia with the flip lid that goes over the keypad that flipped open and reflected your voice in the speaker. The best ergonomic phone that has ever been on the planet. It was a good design. So I think I think what happened there might have been just good technology, not necessarily a social thing. And I'm sure those things intersect, but I just wanted to make that comment. And enjoy the net tonight. I'll be on the side.
Okay, Jim, thank you. You're welcome. It's my pleasure. I don't know. It's the chicken and the egg type of thing. Notice, of course, that flip phones are pretty much a thing of the past. What they used to derisively call the present design chocolate bars has kind of been the mainstay of cell phone designs. For good or for bad, I do not know. I liked my StarTAC, but, you know, there was a weird thing that went on with cell phones for a short while where designers were building them tinier and tinier and tinier, and ultimately they went to an absurd dimension where people could not even push the little buttons on them. And then everyone kind of woke up and said that they were smoking something in the design room. So they went back to larger models. But I don't know. It's a mixture of art and science. You have to understand that the communicator in Star Trek was one guy in the prop department's dream come true that he probably had 2 days to build. And I think the people at Motorola had a heck of a lot more time to do better engineering for it. It was kind of ticky-tacky if you ever actually saw one up close. You know, it looked like if you sneezed on it, it would fall apart.
Oh, great. It was kind of ticky-tacky. It was a great word. But the StarTAC took it further, and that Nokia, as much as that was a little plastic cover, never, ever was there a pocket dial, ever. Never happened.
Well, I guess that's true of all flip-over phones, because how do you pocket dial if you've closed it, if you've flipped it closed? Flip phones were very popular, apparently, with mediocre actors in television dramas. There are a lot of characters to this day that you can see them dramatizing a communications using a flip phone because they just won't stop doing it. It's much more dramatic to flip it closed at the end of an important phone call than just hitting the hang-up button and shoving it in a pocket someplace. Paul, you wanted to say something?
I was going to say, does anyone remember Dick Tracy and the two-way wrist radio?
Yes, indeed. I remember Dick Tracy. I remember the Moon Maid. I remember it all. I wanted a Dick Tracy watch phone. And the closest that I guess we have gone with it is the Apple Watch, but it's not quite the same, but it's okay. But, yeah, I remember Dick Tracy. I used to read it regularly.
DDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I made an interesting discovery. I was trying to get a cover for my Galaxy phone from Samsung, and I couldn't find anything, and they had something there that was horribly expensive. And then I took my TI-89 calculator cover, and I found that it exactly fit over the dimensions, the width dimensions for the Galaxy phone that I have here, and it makes a perfect cover to prevent any misdials or protecting the screen. And I'm just saying it's like that artist on TV says, it's a happy accident that the cover from the TI-89 calculator exactly matches the phone.
Gee, that's intriguing. I wonder if there's any kind of a story behind that, because that's really highly coincidental. You know, there are so many different ways you could get that wrong.
Yeah, I was thoroughly amazed at it, that it fit perfectly. And the TI-89 calculator cover, one side of it is curved, which is nice because it prevents it from just slipping off completely. And the curved side, I put on the end of the phone that has all the connectors for the AirPhone and the charging plug, so it protects those. I mean, it's an amazing coincidence, a happy accident, what's his name, sir?
Yes, indeed. The probability of that, you know, going back again to Star Trek and Spock usually kind of saying, the probabilities is approximately 3,272,553,142 to 1.
Yes, we need the infinite improbability generator to produce that.
Citing the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You have made this a perfect tech net for me, John.
That and a really hot cup of
PhD.
Yes, indeed. You can't leave out the hot cup of tea. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, the conversation has brought up a humorous thought, and I'll preface it with that correlation does not directly relate to causation. But if you look at the evolution of these devices we're talking about, the cell phone to the now smartphone, it was getting ever smaller, as everybody has recognized in the conversation. And it reversed course from becoming ridiculously small to ridiculously big at exactly the moment that body parts started appearing on a device. Of course, correlation does not directly mean causation, but that's how it happened.
Okay. I mean, I have tried various sizes. I entered the zone where my cell phone was uncomfortably a teeny bit too small for me. I tried one of the relatively larger iPhones, and the difficulty of shoving it properly into my front pocket annoyed the heck out of me. So I kind of ended up, the baby bear, the mama bear, the papa bear. I ended up with the slightly smaller version of the iPhone. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. We must do this again, say, next Sunday night at 8 p.m. I thank all of you who participated tonight. I hope you will return next week to help me once again make this an interesting, entertaining, and informative experience. Now it is time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N. Paul, take it away.
Oh, okay. AC2GS WS2N. Very good. This is Paul for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And I'm just listening to all this traffic. Somebody brought up the tones for the Mercury and Gemini missions, you know, the early missions. And they were the Quindar tones. I remember them, and you still hear them. But the purpose of them was you could transmit locally, you know, if you had a transceiver to talk to the astronauts. But if you know, in those days, they would be going around the Earth and they'd pick up different stations, you know, Bermuda or, you know, Madrid or, you know, different locations. To key those radios, they used these Quindar tones. They would transmit, you know, 2,525 was the one tone, and then, you know, that would key it down, and then when you released it, a lower frequency came out, 2475, and that would unkey the distant radio. So that's how they did that way back then, Mark.
Oh, it's nice how everything kind of intersects.
Yeah, and you still hear them, you know. They kept it. They don't need them anymore, of course. You know, you transmit voice and data across the same transmission like we do. You know, with currency tones and all of that. But in those days, that's what they did. You know, you would key the key Bermuda. You know, the transmitter would start transmitting and. And it's unkeyed, you know, when you unkeyed it in Houston, it would unkey there. Some people used to think the astronauts were doing that, but they weren't doing the keying at all. They weren't. It had nothing to do with that. You know, nothing was coming out of the out of Gemini. It was all from Houston. Anyway, let me continue on here. I was on the chat room with John, KD2BD from Jersey, and we were talking about the standby. Okay. We were talking about the ISS passes, and last night there was a real very good one. It was minus 4.2 magnitudes. So lower the number, the better it is. You know, we could probably see minus 1, no problem, minus 1.5, you know, on a good dark sky. But when you get down to minus 4.2 magnitude, it's very bright. And it came, you know, from the southwest, went right over our house, you know, perfect pass, and then off into the horizon, a 6-minute pass. So, I knew some people that were in a different location, in a different house, and they pretty much had an ISS party going out there. Everybody went out and looked at it. It was, you know, since it's Saturday night, they had people over. And I did as well with my wife. So it's always good to watch. Next very bright one, there's a couple more coming up in the next few days, but the next very bright one will be April 1st, another minus 4 plus magnitude pass will be, and that'll go right over the top of the house as well.
Any comments? WS to us. Okay, we always look for ISS passes. Very good. And, I try to mention them every now and then. Once you get, as the month goes by, sometimes the time changes, and eventually you'll see only the passes in the morning. By the way, the passes that we always see is always dusk and dawn because of the light coming from the sun, and yet the space station and us at the time is in darkness, and naturally it's the light reflecting off the space station. The space station is quite big too. Collectively it's about a little bit bigger than a football field. So it's amazing. So it's 250 miles up. You can see it very bright. I think if my eyes were any good, I think I could probably start to make out the solar panels. Okay, there was a launch a few days ago. SpaceX launched a new cargo vehicle going up to the International Space Station, CRS-27. That was very successful. And there was also a launch from Wallops Island, the Electron rocket built by a rocket lab, went off a second launch from Wallops Island, Virginia. Normally they launch out of New Zealand, but that was also very successful. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But I don't know if anybody saw the new spacesuit that NASA is going to be using for the Artemis mission. They had a demonstration of what it looks like last Tuesday, actually in the morning, 10:30. So it was on the NASA website, a company called Axiom, which is really involved with the space station now and with space itself. Axiom is a private company that is now presently sending private people up to the International Space Station every now and then. They've already done one mission. They've got another one coming up in a month or so. And then another one following that. And they send four people up. Always one person has to be an ex-NASA astronaut to be a commander. The next flight going up, Peggy Whitson, she's had at least three flights up to the International Space Station over the years. She's been a commander of her own flights, commander of the International Space Station. Anyway, she's now working directly for Axiom. And she's going to fly the next mission to the space station. And then they have three private people that are paying to go up to the space station. So commercial transportation of people is really starting to take hold. We'll see how that works out. And as time goes on, you put another four people up there right now, you have seven people. You'll have 11 people for 14 days, and then they'll come back. But NASA's able to handle it, so that's what they're doing. So anyway, they had this demonstration of the spacesuit. This company, Axiom, has got the contract from NASA to build these suits. These are going to be the ones that actually walk around on the moon in a couple of years once Artemis 3 actually lands on moon. They'll be sending four people to the moon. Two will stay in orbit and two will go down to the moon's surface. Hopefully on a SpaceX Starship vehicle that hasn't flown yet, but I mean that's the plan right now. But these spacesuits, they did not give out much information about it. They had a guy walking around in it. Very dark looking right now, and they said eventually when they're done it will be white. They didn't give hardly any, I don't know how many different fabrics they have or anything like that. I don't know how long you will be able to walk around on the moon's surface with it. Very few details, unfortunately. One good thing that they did tell you about it is the way they get into the suit. Right now, NASA, when you put a spacesuit on, you put it in the bottom half of it, and then the top part, torso part, comes over you, and it attaches that way. Here, they went with a similar design that the Russians have. Russians have an all-in spacesuit, that's what they call them. And what they have is hinges on the back. So you're able to open up the back, and with that, the backpack itself is attached. It all folds away from the unit. You climb in, you put your feet in first, and then you manage to get your head and your arms into the top part, and then the back part closes. And that's the design they're using. I guess they figured that that's the way to go. They actually copied the Russians on that one. And actually, China, too. China was copied that as well. With their Tiangong space station that's up there, they're doing EVAs. That's the system that they use. So hopefully I'll find out information in the future. How long can you walk around on the surface of the moon with this? How many different fabrics are inside of this? The Apollo missions, when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, everything was done by NASA. It really wasn't a private company. They had plenty of information. We knew there were 17 different layers of different material inside that spacesuit. We know that when they sewed them together, there was, for every stitch, couldn't be more than 1/32nd of an inch apart. Detailed information like that, which is always great when NASA does things. If private companies get involved, I don't know, information tends to go out the window. We knew what type of boots they had. We knew how the boots attached. We knew exactly how much oxygen pressure was in there. 3.7 pounds per square inch was, they have pure oxygen inside that spacesuit. Right now I know nothing about the new spacesuit, unfortunately. Any comments? Anyway, we'll continue on. There's a new rover being built by NASA. Again, this is a NASA contract, so as time goes on, we'll have plenty of information from it. It's called the Viper, the Volatiles Investigation Polar Exploration Rover. Anyway, they call it Viper. It's a 1,000-pound unit on Earth. 1/6 of that one gets to the moon. It'll have four wheels. It's not for people. This is gonna have a drill on it. It's gonna have all kinds of instruments for detecting stuff on the moon. And they have started building the frame of this, which I saw a picture on from the NASA site. So they got the frame, and eventually you're gonna have wheels. And this whole thing will eventually be sent up to the moon in 2024. They actually have a date, November 10th, 2024. The reason they have to know the exact date, they want this thing to be on the moon the whole 14-day part. The moon has daylight for 14 of our days, and then it goes into night the other 14 days. To do it, they need to land on the moon at a certain time to accomplish that. So as long as everything goes smoothly and the development of the rover, and eventually it's going to launch, looks like they're going to launch on a Falcon rocket, most likely. They should have this thing on the moon. There's got to be a couple of things on the moon by the time that it actually land people there. It should be interesting. I think I mentioned last week that one goal that they would like to have is to have a vehicle on the moon before they land and actually be able to film it landing, coming in for a landing. That should be very interesting. By that time, I think they'll get more experience in landing. I know we did very successful 6-man landings with Apollo. NASA did get pretty good at it. They had another half a dozen Surveyor lunar landing missions before that, which landed autonomously. Of course, by now, with all the modern technology, you would think they wouldn't have a problem. Although Italy, not really the question, Italy, India tried it a couple years ago, and Israel tried it a couple years ago to land a vehicle on the moon, and both failed. So, they're both going to try again, but unsuccessful. China has been successful in doing it recently. A couple of landings, including one on the dark side of the moon, or far side of the moon. So, it's a good time to be alive to see all this development, including the future landing of people on the moon. Artemis 3, 4, 5, everyone after that will be landing on the moon, roughly in 1-year intervals. Doesn't seem like much. You would think that they could try to increase that, but they won't. Every 1 year, you're going to have another Artemis launch. The only way you're going to increase that is if a company like SpaceX starts sending their own people to the moon. I mean, they actually have plans of sending Starship around the moon. They actually have a crew plan. They actually have two planned missions where you can have people orbiting the moon and coming back. I think they're a long way from that. Any comments? Another launch I'm looking forward to is in April. The European Space Agency plans on launching a mission to Jupiter. It's called the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, and they call it JUICE. And JUICE will be launched from French Guiana, Kourou launch facility in South America. They plan on launching on one of the last Ariane 5s to ever be launched. They've had like over 80 successful launches with Ariane 5, but that's being retired, and eventually Ariane 6, which should have come online already, will replace it. And that's been delayed, and of course COVID didn't help with the development of that, but sooner or later, Ariane 6, which is supposed to be more powerful and less expensive to launch than Ariane 5, will eventually take over. But for now, this launch will take place in April with the JUICE mission. The plan of the European Space Agency with JUICE the goal is to actually get it first in orbit around Jupiter, and as it goes around Jupiter, it will be passing these different moons, Ganymede first, and Calypso, and then Europa. Now, to get there, they need to do quite a few flybys of planet Earth and actually planet Venus. So they'll orbit the sun, come around near Earth again, and get a gravity assist from Earth, fly around again, and another year, get another gravity assist from Venus, and then I believe two more gravity assists from Earth before, and each time they're getting more elliptical, and at the same time they're gaining speed every time they pass the planet, and the last time past Earth, they'll head out to Jupiter. But that doesn't get them there until 2031, I believe it is. And at that time, they'll be able to do what I said earlier, go into orbit around Jupiter, and then pass all these moons, taking all kinds of pictures and instrumentation, find out everything they can about these moons. But the final orbit around Jupiter, they're going to keep slowing down little by little. Actually, they're going to start going into more of a polar orbit of Jupiter, and eventually orbit Ganymede. The goal is to actually orbit that moon. Ganymede's a big moon. It's actually bigger than our moon. It's bigger than planet Mercury. And that's their final goal, was to get into orbit around that moon. And then years from now, years after that, after doing all kinds of information, searching from Ganymede, they plan on eventually deorbiting Juice and actually crashing into the surface of Ganymede. But it's an interesting flight. We have Europa Clipper, which actually was supposed to get there actually a year before Juice. But we don't plan on orbiting any of the moons. With Europa Clipper, we plan on just orbiting Jupiter. And every time it goes around, they plan on getting closer and closer to Europa, until they get eventually like 100 miles off the surface. But never actually planning on going into orbit around Europa. Europa is close in, very close to Jupiter compared to Ganymede. Ganymede's a little further away, a little less radiation, heavy radiation near Europa. So to go into orbit around that moon could be very problematic for the electronics on board Europa Clipper. Rather than do that, they will stay in orbit around Jupiter, and every time they come near Europa, they'll take all kinds of information, cameras, you name it, and then when they get far away from Jupiter, they'll send information back to Earth. So that's the plan for those two missions. Any comments? Okay, nothing hard. I mentioned the Electron being launched from Wallops Island before. Successful launch. It has a satellite on board. It's a radar satellite. It's a SAR, synthetic aperture radar system. And what it does is one of these satellites that will actually unfurl this big reflector. And for a small satellite, the satellite only weighs a couple hundred pounds. It has a massive reflector. It's going to open up to around 12 feet in diameter. And it's similar to the design to the one I talked about last week, which is still up on Dr. Roy's website, AC2GS, roy.ac2gs.com. If you scroll down a little bit, you can see the one I posted up for for last week, and that's one that's going to be launched. The collaborative mission between NASA and India. Their space program got involved with NASA to build this thing, and that's got a 40-foot diameter reflector on it that will eventually unfurl. That was built by Northrop Grumman. But this is a similar type of design. The only thing is it's very similar, but smaller. It's roughly 12 feet in diameter. But I'm amazed that, such a light spacecraft could, they could put all this gadgetry to open up and unfurl this thing in such a small payload, light payload, to be able to put it onto an Electron rocket. Electron rocket, to give you an idea. It has 9 engines, just like the Falcon 9 does, but very small engines. Collectively, when they all go off, they only have around 55,000 pounds of thrust. And that's enough to get these satellites into orbit. They have plenty of fuel on board, so, they just keep firing away until they get, until the first stage separates and the second stage comes on. And between the two, they're able to achieve orbit. But when you think about it, if you take one engine of a 747, and they're roughly around 55,000 pounds thrust, one engine, you'll have a couple of engines on board a 747, four of them. 747 can't make it into space, but this thing can. It's got liquid oxygen, only 50,000, a little over 50,000 pounds of thrust. Just keeps firing away, and as it gets into the higher atmosphere, gets to a vacuum, no problem. They've launched quite a few of these things. It's around 35 launches of the Electron rocket by Rocket Lab. But, you don't need these massive rockets like the SLS, Space Launch System, or SpaceX with their extra heavy launch vehicle that they're going to be launching with 33 engines. Each one will have over 500,000 pounds of thrust on it to get something into orbit. Here's this Electron rocket, only 67 feet tall, maybe 7 feet in diameter or so, and that's it. I'm just fascinated that, that this thing makes it into orbit, no problem, many, many times. Any comments? Okay, I also mentioned the CRS-27. That was launched by SpaceX, Dragon cargo vehicle. That supports supplies up to the International Space Station, food, water, scientific equipment. SpaceX Dragon on the back, they have a trunk, and every flight that goes up, there's always some piece of equipment, usually that will eventually be pulled out of that trunk because it's open to a vacuum with a robotic arm. Canada ROM too, and then usually attached somewhere on the space station. So this time they brought up a piece of equipment that's built by the Naval Research Laboratory. NRL has developed a lot of satellites that eventually wind up in space, and they always do these pretty interesting experiments. And this one is a power distribution system for space. Eventually, in the future, one of the goals is to collect enough solar energy in space and then transmit it down to Earth. You know, and they're actually working on it. This time, well, the last experiment that the Naval Research Laboratory sent up, they sent a system up that could do that, that could transmit, but only about 3 feet away. Had a transmitter and a receiver. It was all in one package. They just wanted to see if the equipment would work. So they sent it up on the X-37B, which is a vehicle that looks very similar to the shuttle, except it's very small. X-37B has been launched half a dozen times. When they launch it, it goes into space for now, sometimes over 2 years. In the beginning, it was about 6 months. But this time it goes into orbit, and most of the time it's probably a fly satellite. They do bring up experiments for NASA, or in this case, the Naval Research Laboratory, and they have this power distribution set up on board, and it worked. They only transmitted it 3 feet. They're using RF and RF transmitter, RF receiver, and apparently they were happy with it, so they decided to send this thing up. You know, the problem is whatever they transmit out, they're only receiving 1% of that of that wattage. You know, they're transmitting 100 watts, they're only going to get 1 watt out of it, but it's something. So this time they think they've improved on it. This unit's going to be attached to the space station. This one looks like the transmitter and the receiver is a little over 7 feet apart, and I guess they're going to see how that works. I'm sure they have a long way of eventually having the goal of, collecting energy from the sun and transmitting back to Earth, but that's not their only goal. The Naval Research Laboratory would like to develop this to a point where you could use it on Earth. For instance, you could transmit over a hill. The military could use it. You know, if somebody needed power over the hill, they could transmit it to them. You know, which might be a thousand feet away, or 1,000 yards away. So actually, that's one of their goals, to be able to transmit power. But in the long run, I guess, most people with far-out ideas would like to eventually collect, solar energy from space. I mean, you would probably need, 10 football fields to do anything useful, especially if you're only going to get 1 or 2% of the power that you're going to receive. It doesn't seem like a viable system, but they would like to use it on Earth, probably for their military. Any comments? Okay, nothing heard. Another story I've been following is all the Mars orbiters that we have going around Mars. Quite a few of them. It's collectively, between us, European Space Agency, China, India. Well, India had one, but it has stopped working. These are all orbiters that have never been around Mars. There's a Mars Odyssey for NASA, Mars Express from the European Space Agency, MRO, which is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, still in operation around Mars, also NASA, MAVEN, also NASA, there's the Trace Gas Orbiter. That was launched by European Space Agency, and then another one by United Arab Emirates. They have one up there called HOPE, still functioning. As well as one from China. But the engineers are keeping a look a tight look on how Mars Odyssey is doing. Apparently the fuel is eventually starting to run down. Mars Odyssey is the oldest one of the group that's up, that I just mentioned. They were launched, they call it Mars Odyssey 2001, you know, for Space Odyssey 2001. So it's been up there over 20 years, 22 years, functioning, doing great, doing plenty of science.
That
and also
complete.
Now and then using it for a repeater system for anything that's on Mars, you know, the rovers. You know, they used it for Spirit, Opportunity, eventually Curiosity, and of course, now Perseverance. They also used it for a couple of the other lands, like InSight, which is I think that's about to fail. It's covered with Martian dust, but InSight was the one that had the seismometer on there and was able to detect Mars quakes. They used it for another mission called the Phoenix. That thing had landed relatively far north. That worked for a year or so, but they knew it was going to work during the Mars winter, because it was very far north. But all these vehicles needed a repeater system to transmit back to Earth, so they always use Mars Odyssey, they use Mars MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and they even use the Mars Express from the European Space Agency. For a while they used Trace and Maven. They're all capable of doing that repeater-like work to transmit pictures, all the data. But Mars Odyssey, it looks like they were running low on fuel. When they launched from Earth in 2001, they had hydrazine fuel around 500 pounds of liquid sitting on that vehicle. And over all these years, every now and then they have to use a little bit more, you know, to stabilize their orbit. Eventually that starts to run down. And now they think they're only down to around 9 pounds of the stuff. 9 pounds of hydrazine fuel left. But even with that, they think they could get maybe another 2 years out of that vehicle. So that's pretty good. Job well done by whoever put together Mars Odyssey. Any comments? WS2M.
One uniform?
Okay, I heard one uniform. Go ahead. This is WS2N4.
Yeah, this is November, Quebec, one uniform, John. Maybe you're going to get to this later on, but I was wondering if you had a comment or if you know anything about that dark side of the moon, Chinese lander that they put out.
Yeah, that's still operating. It's still operating. And they're able to communicate with it because they have a satellite, their own satellite, in an elliptical orbit that they're able to communicate with. They set that thing up before that launch. But we have plans of doing the same thing eventually, going to the dark side of the moon or the far side of the moon, John. But the last I heard, probably about 6 months ago, it was still operating.
Now, the reason I asked is that I heard some reports that China has said nothing about it lately, and that makes people suspicious that it's not around anymore. I don't know.
A rover on it, and from what I understand, they haven't heard from the rover. That rover might be dead in the water, but the lander itself is still far as I know, still has the capability of transmitting information back. But, yeah, I mean, I'll go.